Yeah?
Now it's beginning.
Okay. Welcome, everybody, to week 6 of Proverbs of Mishlei. Still working on our introduction, and I thought that we would wrap up the introduction this week, but then I started preparing it and realized it's going to bleed into next week, but it probably won't take the entire class next week. I think it'll just be a piece of it. Last week, after we wrapped up discussion of our second question, we went back to our opening question, right? Our second question was it written by Jews? Is it a Jewish written book? Our first question was, how do you deal with the simplicity of the book of Mishlei? Number one, in terms of its statement that you do good, you get rewarded, that kind of thing. And number two, in terms of the fact that a lot of its advice could really be read on a very basic level and doesn't have a whole lot of depth to it. So what I want to do this week is complete our look at that question and then talk about the legacy of the book of Mishlei. What happens after the book is closed? What happens to it in terms of its influence on other texts, in terms of its commentaries, and in terms of its midrash, and in terms of its role in our liturgy? Like, where does Mishlei go from here? Where do you go from being included in Tanakh? So, we'll see.
What did you mean by when the book is closed, where you go?
When don't we, I don't mean closed like closed, I mean canonized. That's what I didn't mean closed like you close a book. No, thank you for pointing that out. So, when we started to answer our question of the apparent simplicity of the book, we gave one approach, and that approach was to say that Mishlei is intended as a book of instructions for the young, either directly for the young, right, Moshe Lichtenstein's position, which I've heard attributed to Rabbi Shalom Carmi as well, which we saw support for in Avigdor Horowitz's work, or alternatively, meant for adults to give to the young, teachers, parents, grandparents. And that was all within this idea that, okay, the book is a little simple because it's meant to be. Its audience is relatively simple, and you need to take that kind of an approach when you're dealing with a younger audience. The second approach is to say no. Everyone can benefit from wholesome emuna and simple advice. As far as simple advice, we already quoted last week Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato in his introduction to Mesilat Yesharim, who said, you know, it's good to review the basics. Yeah, getting ourselves all into the sophistication causes us sometimes to miss and to forget things that we really should know. But beyond that, the text in Mishlei offers depth according to our commentators. And here I wanted to go back to a verse that we quoted last week as an example of simplicity and show you what the commentators do with it. So if you take a look at chapter 21, sentence 13. I picked this one just because it was one of those that we brought as an example of simplicity, so I wanted to show you how it can stop being simple. You could do the same thing with any number of verses in this book. So the text says, 21:13, Otem ozno mizakas dal, someone who seals his ear from the cry of the indigent, of the poor, gam hu yikra, he will also end up calling out, velo yeone, and he won't be answered. If you don't listen when others are suffering, beware. When you're in a position of need, no one's going to listen to you either. So it does sound very straightforward, right? It's about ignoring the call of the needy and how that will lead to bad results for a person. But now watch this. Take a look, please, at source number 2. For some reason, I flipped it on my... I see what I did. Source number 1 wasn't supposed to be there. Source number 1 was a holdover from last week. Okay, nonetheless, it lives on in our sheet. Source number 2. Rabbi Menachem Meiri, he says, "Kima'amar ha'chacham la'melech," as the sage said to the king, and he doesn't mean a particular sage, and he doesn't mean a particular king. But he says, Zachor ki lo yirucham machar mi shalo yircham hayom. Remember that one who does not display mercy today will not be treated with mercy tomorrow. Right? That's the simple read. V'yichlol zeh, that includes, kol mi she'oseh atzmo ke'achzar levoltihe aser l'chaveiro b'meshu tzarech lo. Anybody who makes himself cruel, not listening to somebody else who needs him, kifi asher tasig yado, to whatever extent one is able to afford to assist, ve'af b'derech nistar, but then he adds a layer, he says, on a hidden level, tifarshehu al minias limudo mehare uyim lo. It also refers to not teaching those who are worthy of learning. In other words, chesed is not only about giving tzedakah. It's not only about holding a door for somebody. It's sharing your knowledge as well. V'gam hu lo yeyane. And such a person also will not be answered. In what way? Kilo tishlam chochmaso bezulat zeh. If he doesn't share his wisdom with others, he won't become wiser. Meaning, when you learn with others, especially when you teach others, you learn more yourself, right? I'm exhibit A. I wouldn't know anything without you. It's the learning that you do with other people that gives you so much more. So he says there's another layer going on here. It's about education and about natural consequences. It isn't just if you don't give, no one's going to want to give to you. But it's also a natural consequence if you don't share your learning. The result is going to be that you will also not gain in terms of learning, but the Meiri is not done. He throws in a third point. O tefaresh dal al hayeled hamiskein. He says this is also a parenting lesson. The dal, the needy person in this sentence, is the weak child. Ve'im yashki'uhu im achiv hagadol mimenu. If you set him with his older brother, lo yuchal od lahashivo, you're not going to be able to get him back. I'm not entirely clear on what he means with this last piece of advice, with his parenting layer here, but it sounds like what he's saying is that if you have a child who's a weak child and you put that child at the mercy of the tougher older sibling, the result may be that this kid is going to hate you forever. This kid is maybe going to follow the older sibling. I don't know exactly what he's saying. But my point in bringing the Meiri's approach with his three layers in the text is that he's saying to you, don't read this text on the simple level and leave it there. There's level upon level in the text, right? If you go back to what we said, hang on one second, Joyce. If you go back to what we said when we talked about the fact that Shlomo was credited with writing thousands of parables, but there are only 915 verses in Mishlei, right? We said, according to some, the answer is because there are multiple levels to some of these verses, and therefore it's layer upon layer upon layer. That's the way the Meiri reads this. I saw your hand, Joyce, but I'm going to ask you to wait a little bit because I want to take us through the Vilna Gaon on this sentence and the Malbim on this sentence, and then I'll take all the questions and comments. So the Vilna Gaon offers me another approach. He says, when this pasuk, when this verse talks about the za'akat dal, the cry of the indigent, it doesn't mean a beggar. It doesn't mean the person who is asking you for help at all. You know what it means. It means the Yetzer Tov. It means that inclination in a person to do that which is good. And he's linking it to a verse in Koheles, actually. It's Koheles chapter 9, sentence 15, which in context talks about an ish miskein v'chacham, a poor and wise man who saves a city, but no one listens to his advice. That's the Yetzer Tov. So take a look at what the Vilna Gaon does with this in source number 3. He says, Pshuto kimashma'o. The simple meaning is as it sounds. You don't help the needy, you won't get helped either. It's because the Yetzer Tov is called a poor sage. That's the reference to Koheles. And when a person seals his ears so that he doesn't hear this person cry out, or the Yetzer Tov cry out, and one doesn't leave his own sins because he keeps on following what the Yetzer Hara tells, because he doesn't do what the Yetzer Tov tells him to do. Achar kach gam hu yikrov alo yeyaneh. Then he is going to cry out, and at that point no one's going to listen. He's going to say, wait, I want it to be good, and it's too bad. And he gives you references to different verses in Mishlei that support that idea, that the person who didn't listen to wisdom when he had the opportunity is going to, in the end, cry out, and at that point it's going to be too late. So for example, he gives you a reference to chapter 8, sentence 1, excuse me, in which it says, Halo chokhma tikra, wisdom cries out to you, utvuna titein kola, understanding calls forth, it gives its voice, it tries to be heard, but you have to be up for listening. That's the Vilna Gaon's idea. This sentence is not just about help the guy on the street and then others will help you. It's also about listening to your Yetzer HaTov. But wait, there's more. We take a look at the Malbim, commenting still on our same verse. And Malbim says it's about being a judge. It's advice to the judge. Yesh Hevdel, he says. This is classic Malbim. He says, there is a word that we use in this sentence for the needy person. The word is dal. But there's another word we see in Tanakh for a needy person, and that is rush. Reish shin. Rush. Happens
Russia.
Quite... No, Russia. Not Russia. Russia is wicked. Rush is just somebody who's indigent. Reish shin. Like, don't be in a rush, except with Hebrew letters. So he says... Yesh Hevdel bein hadal ubein harash. There's a difference between dal and rush. Shehadal nisdaldel minechasav. The dal has been separated from his assets. Dal is a term that we use to subtract something. So his assets, he had assets. However, they were subtracted from him. Valpia rov. And in general, yiyez al yedei eshek or oshek v'chamas. How does it happen to somebody that his assets are subtracted from him? He got cheated by somebody. Somebody stole them from him. And now he lands in court. V'hu zo'ek el ha'shoftim la'tzil ashruk miyad oshkav. He cries out to the judges, save me from the one who is harming me. Somebody is after me. This is the way the Rambam and others frame the mission of a judge. La'atzil ashuk miyad oshko. To save those who have been cheated from those who cheat them. Vashofet she'otem ozno. The judge who seals his ear. Ve'eno moshialo bihios le'el yado. He doesn't save him even though he has the power to do it. Yiya onsho she'ye oshek gam hu ve'yikrav alo ye'aneh. His punishment is going to be... He'll get cheated, and he's going to cry out, and no one's going to answer him. Bein bedine shamayim, mida keneged mida, whether from God, measure for measure. You didn't help the vulnerable, so I'm not going to help you. Bein bedine aretz, or in human court. Shekemoshu lo asa mishpat, just like he didn't practice justice, you do kebashar, ve'ein matzil, he'll be crushed at the gate, and no one's going to save him. So it's regarding a judge. So what I'm trying to show you here, and I'm going to pause for questions, is multiple layers to what we thought was a simple sentence. Right? It sounded like, you know, when we started this, even 10 minutes ago, we thought, okay, simple advice. You don't help those in need, you won't be helped either. And the Meiri says, it means if you don't teach those who are worthy, you won't become wiser. If you don't take care of your young children, you will lose them. In Vilna Gaon throws in, if you don't listen to the Yetzer HaTov, you're going to go looking for good advice and a conscience, and you ain't going to find it. And the Malbim says, if you're a judge and you are corrupt in your judgment, then that corruption is going to come back to bite you and you won't get helped. All these different layers to a simple text. Joyce, you waited. Thank you.
I was going to support the Meiri, because Hashem asked both Abraham and Moses to educate the people.
Right. This is true. So you're supporting the Meiri because you're saying that this is about teaching the worthy and then gaining as a result. Very good. Thank you. Janine.
I just find that this is so much more satisfying than the approach we learned last week. I feel that Rav Moshe Lichtenstein's approach trivializes this. And as a matter of fact, he brings a proof or a support that we teach Chumash or the Torah on a very simplistic level to young children, which we do, but we still have sages studying it.
Yes.
So again, it just, not to mention that we probably, all of us, if you look around us in society, all of us could use the reminders of simple mentalist kind, I guess, which is
yeah. No, you're right. I mean, I would point out where Moshe Lichtenstein's point was not about Chumash broadly. It was about learning it on a simple level versus learning it in depth. That was what he...
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
Which makes sense even for this. You could, you know, learn on a simple level for a 6-year-old, but...
True.
There's something in there for everybody.
But now I'm going to go back the other way. Susan, I see your hand. I'm going to go back the other way and say that, I think there's something really positive about the idea that there is guidance for kids in Tanakh. Like, I think that's good, that Tanakh should be for them also. Not only, well, this is the adults and they're going to give you some, you know, baby food version of it, but that there's something in Tanakh. You can open up a Tanakh, you can read Mishlei, and it's going to speak to you in a way that you understand and can apply to your life. You know, the Gemara talks about Tanakh, and the commentators talk about Tanakh being Moshech Es Halev. It draws the heart. And they're worried that if people spend too much time on Tanakh, they aren't going to learn more challenging things. There has been historically a view of Tanakh that way. So I don't want to dismiss the first view, even though my heart is actually with the second view as well. I don't want to dismiss that first view outright. I think that there's great value in the idea that you should have a book in Tanakh that can speak to kids and help them to grow up to become good adults. I think there's something to be said for that. Susan and then Ricky.
You know how I always like to find something today?
Yeah.
Right now Israel has gone to...
So I'm gonna cut you off. I apologize. I'm not going there. I'm not going there because I don't want to have to present both sides. And I would feel dishonest if I did not present it. So I am going to ask you, do me a favor. I know you don't think there are both sides. I'm not going there. Please? Thank you. Ricky.
Two things. First of all, what we just learned, it sounds very much like what Eastern religions call karma. And then there is some stories about when Abraham sent his people east. This is the source of similarities between our thoughts and Eastern religions. I had a friend who was a Zen Buddhist, and I would talk about what I was learning. She says, yeah, well, in Zen we call it this, and in Zen we call it that. That was quite a few years ago. So that was one thing, and then after you answer me, I want to say something else.
So I would be reticent to associate it with karma, because I think karma is a bigger idea than you know, what you do comes back to you. I think that there's more to be... Karma is not the same thing as natural consequences. So I would be a little bit careful about making the link, although certainly the colloquial use of the term karma matches what you're saying. That I would agree with. Before you go to your second point, I just want to apologize, Susan. I was a little bit harsh and I didn't mean to be. I'm just allergic a little bit to the topic, so that's part of it, but I really don't want to take it up here because there's a lot to be said about what's going on, and I don't think that I want to go there. Ricky, what was your second point?
My second point, I still want to go back to it being very simplistic, as in setting up false expectations, because bad things happen to good people. And it's not necessarily because they did something bad. It's far more complicated than, yes, you don't do this, so this happens. I don't think Hashem works this way. I think when we're rewarded or punished, it's based on so many other things other than, well, I didn't do that, and therefore this is happening to me. So again, it's simplistic and it sets up, I was good, why is this happening to me? So
I'm gonna hold off for 1 second on that part, because right now we're just dealing with the issue of the simple nature of the advice. Next we get to the question of its view of bad things happening to good people and so on. That's what we're gonna talk about in a minute. Other questions on the simple layer, or simple, you know, type of advice that it gives. Okay. Then let's talk the reward and punishment piece of it. So you could, again, go back and say this is meant as instruction for the young. However, I think presenting the world, in its ideal form also has value. And I go back to something that we learned when we did Eov and the statement from Carol Newsom, which I have found useful in so many different contexts. I've quoted this in I don't know how many different classes, where she talks about narratives. This is her comment, which we learned when we were learning Eov, and we saw that when Eov was suffering, he was visited by his three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and how they start trying to tell him that bad things happen if you do bad things, and if you do good things, then good things will happen. And she asks the question of, are you really setting up ridiculous caricatures, you know, for his visitors? No one actually believes that. That doesn't fit anybody's lived experience. And look what she says in number 5 from her book, The Book of Job, A Contest of Moral Imaginations. She says, yet if such statements were intended as universal, exceptionless claims, right? You do good things, you get good. You do bad things, you get bad. If you think that's universal and there are no exceptions, only a deluded fool could believe them. And whatever the friends may be, they are not fools, right? That's very important to understand. Eov's friends are not cardboard cutouts. What is at stake between Job and the friends is making evident the nature of the world, which each attempts to communicate through vivid evocations. Each one is trying to show you a way to look at the world. The persuasive power of an iconic narrative does not derive from a simple empiricism. It isn't that you look at the world and you come up with your narrative and poof, that's the way the world is. Although it cannot be wholly disconfirmed by experience and remain plausible, the story remains surprisingly resilient in the face of a mixture of conforming and non-conforming experience. In other words, to put that into English, what she's saying is, your narrative, your explanation for how the world works, won't survive if it's never true. If someone tries to tell you this is the way the world is, and it's never borne out by reality, then no, people will not accept it. At that point, it will be disconfirmed by experience, and that'll be that. However, narratives that people have, understandings that people have for the way the world works remain resilient, even when there is some experience that doesn't fit. And she gives you an example. She says, consider popular business literature, in which the story is told over and over of the individual who turns a creative idea into a flourishing business. This is the iconic narrative of entrepreneurial capitalism. Everyone knows that the large majority of new businesses fail, yet the story does not lose its power. That story is seen as expressing the nature and essence of an entrepreneurial society with all the static cleared away. This is the way the world should work. This is the way the world often works. Yeah, sometimes it doesn't work. But this is the way it is. You work hard, you're honest, you have a creative idea, you're going to succeed. An anecdote about the success of the wicked cannot explain the reality of this world of values, which is experienced as such every day. Okay? When you see in the world something bad happens to somebody who doesn't seem to deserve it, that is not going to mean the entire world is corrupt, no one ever gets rewarded for their good deeds, that's the way the whole world... No. Such things may happen, but they are perceived as anomalies, lacking explanatory power. They aren't the way the whole world is. They're anomalies. But the story of the wicked overtaken by calamity, like the story of the restoration of the good person, rings true because it is consonant with the foundational values of the society. We have a set of values, a belief that this is the way the world works, a worldview, and Tanakh establishes that for us. And that's what I argue Mishle is doing. Mishle is trying to set that tone for us. You follow? And now I will make what I think is my favorite point in this, which is, I said to you last week, Mishle could be construed as a response to wisdom literature. That's what I think is going on here, right? We talked about that last week. The idea that the book of Mishle is effectively responding to the wisdom literature in other cultures. We talked about how the Rambam sees certain mitzvos as responses to things in other societies. We talked about the idea that the sota is a response to what they do in other societies in adultery or suspected adultery situations. Right? We had all of that. Maybe that's what's going on here. You could do the same thing. Mishle is a response to the wisdom literature found in other cultures. If you take a look at source number 6, Hurwitz sees it as a dialogue going on within Tanakh itself. Look what Hurwitz says. Miteva hadvarim, by nature, safrut hachochma ha'iyunit hi bikoratit be'ofya. Wisdom literature is inherently critical. Umoked or mokad ha'bikoret hu sifrut hachochma ha'didaktit v'toroseha. He says the target of that criticism is didactic wisdom literature and its teachings. What he means by that is the wisdom literature that is analytic, the type of wisdom literature that looks at the world and says bad things are happening out there, criticizes, it's a response to, the teaching wisdom literature like Mishle. Meaning the books of Job, and Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, which are all doom and gloom, and people are suffering, and things are unjust, and all of that, they examine, and look at my translation, I think I did a good job, examine and criticize the wisdom presented in the book of Mishle. There's a tension going on, a clash between Eov and Koheles on the one hand, and Mishle on the other. Eov says, sometimes people suffer, and you want to know why? You can't understand. God says, sorry, you can't understand it. Koheles, we're going to see after we finish with Mishle, Koheles says, sometimes things aren't fair. Sometimes things are not just. There are good people who get destroyed. That happens. It's a criticism of Mishle. Mishle says, oh, no. The world is a just world. Things are good. Keep on reading. Sefer Mishle Matzigas Ha'olam Haratsui. The book of Mishle presents the ideal world. Umores haderach lahasagas olam zeh. It teaches how to get there. Lumat zot, on the other hand, Sifrei Iov v'Koheles hamatzigim es haolam hamatzui. Iov, Koheles, which portray the world that we see, that exists right now. Misyashim imenu, they give up hope. Omashlimim ito, or they make peace with it, but the less brera, they say, well, we have no choice, we're just stuck with this broken world as it is. Mibikoret ha-chochma ha-mushmat b'sifrut ha-chochma ha-iyunit. From the criticism taught in this analytic wisdom literature, mishtameya she-chochmat ha-sifrut ha-didaktit hi idealistit b'midah rabah u-mitbaseset lo ma'at al-tikva ve-emunah. It shows that the didactic wisdom literature is idealistic. And it's based, not in small part either, on hope and faith. So what Mishle is trying to do it is portraying the desired world and the way to get there. That's the idea. Professor Michael Fox, quoted by Rabbi Chaim Angel, says, Mishlei sees the world through the lens of wisdom. Kohelet sees the world empirically as it is experienced. Rabbi Angel adds another layer. He points out that it's this internal Tanakh debate, right? You've got Mishlei on one pole, Iyov Kohelet on the other. Essentially, I guess what he's really saying is the same as what we just saw in Hurwitz. But I would add one more layer, and it's going to come back to a pasuk that somebody quoted last week. And that is David HaMelech's observation in Tehillim. Nar hayisi v'gam zakanti v'lo ra'isi tzadik neza v'zaro mevakesh lachem. I was young, I became old, and I never saw a youth who was, I never saw a righteous person abandoned and his children seeking bread. The David's own personal experience seems to be in conflict with this. David goes through a terrible period of being abandoned, being snubbed, being pursued, right? Without friends, without allies. Nabal won't help him, and so on. Nonetheless, this is David's belief about how the world works. And elsewhere, I've given other explanations for the pasuk, and I know that people have many different explanations for the pasuk, and some of them are probably true. But nonetheless, I think that you could simply say that when that idea that David expresses in Tehillim is expressed in Mishlei, Mishlei is saying, this is our value. This is our default. We look at the world from this perspective. And if something doesn't fit, we have a responsibility to do something about it. But this is the ideal and the way to understand the world. You follow?
Could you repeat that?
No, I could not. Sorry, I really couldn't say it again. I don't know. I could tell you what I was basically saying, which was that I think that pasuk has other meanings and other ways to take it in its context in Tehillim. I'm a big believer in the idea that Tehillim is prayer, and David is not saying this is my observation. He's saying this is my tefillah, is what I'm davening for. But when that idea shows up in Mishlei, it's not a prayer. Mishlei is not a siddur. It's not a book of prayer. When that type of idea shows up in Mishlei, I think it's a statement of, this is my belief about the default, how the world works. And I have to fix it if it's not, right? Like we saw in 21:13, I have to fix it if somebody is suffering. But that's my narrative for the way the world is to be seen,
so
experienced, and understood.
Shows us, has a belief in how the world should be.
Yes. Yes. That's my thought. So that's, again, you know, you could just say it's education for the young. They need to grow up with certain ideas until they get older and find other things happening. That you could say that. However, to me, I think that this is meant for the old also. And I think it's meant to be a statement of values and a narrative. This is what the world, this is the way to look at the world. And anomalies have to be fixed. That's the way I would look at it. Questions and comments? Nope. Okay. Wow. Just like that, we've solved all our problems. Okay.
No?
No?
No.
No. Go ahead, Jonathan. Oh.
But no. Can I go ahead?
Yes.
Nope, that's not me. That's a lady.
Go ahead, Jonathan. I'm hearing you.
Okay, good. Thank you. No, I agree with what's said, but I think there's a problem in thinking this is anything but a natural world, the way it works, as they say, and should be taught to the kids, but should be taught that this is not something we have to struggle with. It's the way the world works. Accept it and do your best within the framework. It's not something.
When you say this, hang on. When you say this is the way the world works, what do you mean by this?